And that's Flashpoints on your community radio station, KBOO Portland, 1 minute before 11 o'clock. In about a half hour, join us for the radio zine. Today, the guest is Drew Cameron, and he talks about his work with the Combat Paper Project that works directly with communities affected by combat to transform military uniforms into sheets of paper. But first, it's Between the Covers coming right up. Today, host Leanne Krantz welcomes author Eden Lapucky, and that is coming up next on KBOO. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for KBOO Community Radio. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor The Willamette Speaks, Stories of the Lower Willamette River, on Saturday, August 23rd, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the BES Water Lab, 6543 North Burlington in North Portland. This storytelling event will feature the Grand Ronde Tribe's history of the river, as well as drumming by tribal members. Raconteur Roger Wendlick will offer a description of Lewis and Clark's first impressions of the Lower Willamette, and Sean Morgan will describe experiences living aboard a sailboat at Willamette Cove. The Willamette River Superfund Community Advisory will be on hand to offer updates, information, and opportunities for community feedback. Again, that's The Willamette Speaks, Stories of the Lower Willamette River, Saturday, August 23rd, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the BES Water Lab. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program featuring interviews with authors of fiction and nonfiction. I'm your host this week, Leanne Krantz. Our guest is Eden Lapucky, whose debut novel, California, has become the book of the summer. After being recommended by author Sherman Alexie on the Colbert Report in an interview about the current Amazon Hachette publishing dispute. But the book stands on its own. California is a mid-apocalyptic tale of human survival. It explores the ways humans organize themselves into communities after a collapse, and the extremes to which a person will go to keep their family safe. The story follows a young couple, Frida and Cal, who left the rubble of Los Angeles to make a go of it in the wilderness. They live an isolated life of gardening and gathering until Frida learns she's pregnant. Her primal urge for community surmounts her fear of coming into contact with dangerous bands of young males called pirates, not to mention what they might encounter when they attempt to cross the junk-spiked border of the nearest community. Eden Lapucky is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop and a staff writer for The Millions. She is the author of the novella If You're Not Yet Like Me, and her short fiction has been published in McSweeney's and Narrative magazine. She is the founder and director of Writing Workshops Los Angeles, and California is her debut novel. Eden Lapucky gave a reading at Powell's Books on August 13th and stopped by KBOO for this interview. Welcome, Eden Lapucky.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on the success of your book.
Thank you so much.
So, what inspired you to write an apocalyptic tale?
There are a couple of moments, a couple of things that happened before I started writing. The first was that the phrase post-apocalyptic domestic drama popped into my mind one day, and I thought, wow, I want to read that book. But I didn't necessarily think that I wanted to write that book, mostly because I hadn't read that many post-apocalyptic novels. Although The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood is one of my favorite books of all time. Mm-hmm. So I certainly had that kind of in my system as a writer, and maybe one day it was going to come out of me at some point. And then once I was in LA driving on Sunset, and the streetlights above me had gone out, and there was just something really eerie about it. It was in a stretch of Sunset where there weren't a lot of businesses, and it was just eerie and dark, and there weren't that many people around in an area that usually has people around. And it got me thinking about what what the city would be like if there were no services, if there were no streetlights ever, and if the roads didn't get repaired, and there was no fire department, and no police force, and then schools closed. And I just sort of, and you know, that's a reality in cities today, in some cities today, unfortunately. So it's not that far off, but it definitely got my brain kind of thinking. If this, then this. And I kind of conjectured in that way. And it's somewhere along the line, that line of conjecture melded with my thinking of this young couple and thinking about how they would leave a city like that. And that couple became Frida and Cal. But I didn't think too hard about the post-apocalyptic genre while I was writing it. I think because it's such a grand tradition, and that if I really thought about it, I would have not written the book at all. I think I would have been too intimidated. So instead, I really just focused on the characters and their kind of isolated life in the wilderness, and didn't think about myself as embarking on this, as being part of this grand tradition, because that would be too scary.
So the collapse in your book is cumulative. So can you talk about some of the natural and human events that precipitated it?
So there are a couple things. First of all, I'll say I didn't want to make it about one singular event. I find those books and those movies to be really fun to watch and read. But I don't find them particularly scary, because I don't think as the viewer or the reader, you are complicit in the making of the future world. You kind of are just powerless to what will happen to you. And in the world that I've created, I wanted it to feel close and kind of uncomfortably near and maybe uncomfortably familiar. So I just took things that I am anxious about and went from there. So I'm really anxious about climate change. And so I gave the Midwest and the East some big storms that basically killed and decimated cities and killed a lot of people. I made the oil crisis so keen that people really couldn't afford to move anymore. So you couldn't really, to drive across town would cost a certain amount of money, and you couldn't fly anymore. So that of course would bring the economy to a halt. I threw in some earthquakes earlier on, so when the wife character Frida and her brother Micah, when they're teenagers, there's some earthquakes that really wreck the economy of LA. And then a year later, I think, or 6 months later, there's an earthquake in San Francisco. So California has kind of been decimated on that front. And then I added some good old-fashioned terrorism. I don't know why I'm laughing. But violence, you know, I actually wrote the book before things like the Boston bombing happened or a lot of the recent gun violence. My book was long finished by the time the gun violence at Sandy Hook, for instance, or at the movie theater in Colorado, all of that stuff happened afterwards. But it was already a very big fear of mine, and so I kind of plopped that into the book as well. And what I want readers to feel like, you know, this is what's startling about the book and what's scary about the book, is that it doesn't feel that far from the future, and it's not if we don't sort of wake up a little bit, maybe.
Yeah, it was eerily possible, everything that you mentioned, and it led to the crash. As I mentioned, one of the major themes in this book is community and how we come together after a disaster, and how we relate to neighboring communities. It really was very thought-provoking. Could you talk a little bit about how the people have organized themselves in your novel?
They're in the cities, they're only mostly the poor and maybe, you know, the struggling middle class are left in the cities, because I made it so that all of the rich have fled the cities and live in these communities with a capital C, which are very hard to get into. You need a lot of money for the membership, and exactly how one is sort of invited into these communities is nebulous to those who can't afford to be in them in the first place. And everyone left is sort of left to just rot in the cities and fend for themselves. But I was also interested in the ways that we create communities that are not official communities with a capital C. So even in the city, Frida's brother Micah, who is a suicide bomber, he was part of a movement to kind of fight against the rich taking all the resources. And he and his group, the group, they started something called an encampment in Echo Park in an east side neighborhood of LA. And they themselves are sort of a community that, you know, is ostensibly devoted to promoting equality, but yet they are also an enclosed community. And Frida and Cal, in a way, they are their own two-person community, which is both a solace to them and also really trying when it's just you and one other person at the end of the world. And when you're in any kind of enclosed community, or, you know, if you think of a relationship as a kind of enclosed community, there are certain, you know, there's certain dynamics that develop between you and the members of said community. And there's certain safeties that are provided and certain solaces, but also some dangers and secrets and all those kinds of things.
Yes. It raised a lot of questions, you know, about what we seek as humans after trouble comes. You know, we're compelled to seek certain things and to feel safe and comfortable, and we're willing to give up certain things to get them. These communities, they're just, you know, whether it's the privileged community where things are kind of pretending to be like America used to be, or the encampment, which is the renegade of the people encampment, inhabitants are losing something about of their freedom, I would say.
Yeah, and it's funny, when I was writing the book, I actually didn't intend for that. Not that I intended for it to be otherwise, but I sort of just wrote the book, and then, I mean, some themes are obvious, but they're obvious least to the writer while writing. And I think if I had gone into it thinking I'm going to talk about communities and the ways that we sacrifice things to be part of a whole, I think it would have come off a little bit too heavy-handed and too didactic.
Different book, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. But that's definitely something I was going for. And I also was really, one of the things I'm very much interested in is the way that people become selfish or not their best selves under pressure. And I think in particular with certain apocalyptic narratives, they're aspirational in some ways. So if you think about, I recently read The Hunger Games and Divergent, actually, thinking I might write something about young adult dystopias and what they mean for teenage girls. I still like the idea of writing that. Someday I shall write it. But I was thinking a lot about how those books are truly aspirational and inspiring to think that if you were a girl who got chosen to be part of a thing where you had to fight to the death, you would be really powerful and you would be able to be brave. But in fact, I don't know if my real self would be those things. And I don't know if one is their best self in a relationship when the world is ending. when it's not only just, you know, we have to pay the rent and who's going to clean up after dinner, but also, you know, are we going to live through the winter and do we have enough food and did you forage well? Did you get the right berries so we don't die? And you have to wash your clothes in the creek and all of those very everyday things. So I was definitely thinking about the ways that people become selfish and petty in hard situations. Mm-hmm. And the way that sometimes we make a choice that, you know, because there are a lack of better choices and, you know, it's not, you know, you might choose to be safe and have to give up so many other things, but it's really the best option. And maybe the best option is still sort of a bad option. But there are jokes in my book, too. It sounds very dark, the way I'm describing it.
Yeah, it does not come across as a dark, dire book. Yeah. It freaked me out, though, I have to say.
Well, mission accomplished.
And I think you're attracting a lot of new readers to this genre.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about having my book go be on Colbert, I mean, besides just it being totally wonderful and weird and beyond anything I ever expected or hoped, I'm both getting readers, I think, who would not normally read the genre, which is actually more of the type of reader that I am, because I mostly read, I like to say, literary fiction about people talking in rooms, and that's about all that happens. So I'm getting those kind of readers who maybe are wouldn't otherwise not read a post-apocalyptic book. Mm-hmm. And I'm also getting readers who read nothing but that. And, you know, it's an interesting, it's a happy problem to have, is to have a kind of vast spectrum of different kinds of readers, but it's been interesting to see the different kinds of ways that people respond to the book depending on what they normally gravitate towards subject-wise.
We're speaking with Eden Lepucky about her debut novel, California. You might not have intended this either, but the year the book takes place is in 2050s.
Yes.
Right? And some things have not changed, especially about type of people who become leaders. In order to become a leader, it seems you need charisma and a show of force.
Yeah.
And it's also male-led and the power is not transparent. And it was also a lesson to the reader about, are we really going to go this way again? You know, it doesn't work. And you can just sense that it's not going to hold.
I was definitely thinking along those lines. I mean, I wasn't exactly sure what I meant to say, but I was certainly interested in thinking about groups of people who longed to start the world over because the world as they had left it was pretty terrible. And thinking about, I'm generally interested in, I think, the ways that idealism gets morphed into something.
Can get off track.
Yeah, to get off. And I think it's actually very easy. I mean, this is such a small example, but while I was writing this book, my husband and I almost bought a house, and it didn't happen for all these different reasons. But I remember we were trying to buy this little two-bedroom house in this okay neighborhood. It was kind of hairy, but, you know, we were going to make it work, and it was a really nice neighbors. And I remember thinking that, but when I owned this property, if there ever came a time when, by law, houses were required to be, say, solar powered or something, I could see myself fighting against that because now I owned property and I couldn't afford to make the changes. Whereas if I want to, as a younger, more idealist person, I would fight for that and everybody should do it. I mean, this is such a small, weird, random example that's popping into my head right now. But I do think it's easy for people to get, like, as you say, off the track of what they intended to do or to be the people that they wanted to be.
Yeah.
And I also think it's true that leaders often are both a combination of charisma, ideals, manipulation, and subterfuge. I mean, people who want to go into politics, I admire them in some ways, and I'm a little bit wary of them in others. And I also think if you want to start the world over, you would want to start it without certain trappings of the previous world that failed. But could that be possible? And would things like racism and sexism persist after the end of the world? Would they be obliterated by larger problems? Would they be magnified? So I was definitely thinking along those lines as I wrote the book. And I was one of the major concerns of the book is the sort of gender roles in the book of, you know, would we be worse off from that perspective if things really went wrong?
There's a quote, the character Frida, I'm going to paraphrase a little bit. She says, Frida thought that the worse things got, the more women lost what they'd worked so hard to gain. No one cared about voting rights and equal pay. You say, the only thing that mattered was upper body strength, brute force. Yeah, that was just another chilling realization.
It's a scary thing to think about. That actually was inspired by, I started the book at this artist residency called U-Cross in Wyoming, and while I was, which is an amazing place that everybody should apply to, and they offer a ranch tour because it's in Wyoming and it's on a working ranch, and they take you to this kind of abandoned railroad town where there's an old ghost house, like ghost town, like an abandoned house there. And I was with the author Ben Fountain, and he said something to the effect of, oh, women used to get hernias all the time in these pioneer towns because they were trying to, you know, build the town along with the men, and they just couldn't. He probably didn't say it in those words. In fact, I'm sure he didn't. But it just got me thinking about the skills I have And would they be valued in a world where you really do need to carry firewood all the time? And how I would, I mean, there are times when as a woman, I am happy my husband or any man is there. And if I have to walk somewhere at night and thinking about how I don't have the freedom that I would like to have because of, I'm afraid. And I think it would only be magnified in the middle of the woods where there was, I mean, I wouldn't be afraid of, say, rapists, but I would be afraid in other ways because I wouldn't be able to defend myself. And to have to being, and to be forced to return to one's body and not be able to use anything else. And to be, you know, in the, my book, there's so much attention paid to Frida's period that doesn't exist nowadays, or not in my day-to-day life. You know, people aren't discussing my menstrual cycles, but that is that's a central issue in the lives of my characters. And to think, what would it be like to have to return to that kind of existence?
Yeah, it was definitely a new reality. And everything that mattered before was obsolete. And it made me really ponder what aspects of my daily life now would vanish in some sort of apocalypse. And, you know, what's really meaningful? What are meaningful ways to spend my time? What am I investing in? You know, it was really, it took me to some deep places, I must say. Because it was so accessible and it was so possible. It was easy to picture myself in those circumstances.
Thank you. I just heard from a friend about this. Before the advent of electricity, people used to go to sleep much earlier, like with the sun, after the sun went down. Mm-hmm. And so they actually had first sleep and second sleep. I had never heard of this. I thought, I have to tell somebody. You're now everybody on the radio. But they would go to sleep at sundown, and then they would wake up in the middle of the night, and they would be up for a little while, and then they would go to sleep a second time until the sun rose. And it was just a totally different way of sleeping and kind of a different way of demarcating time. And something that, and I kind of wish I knew this because it would definitely have been put in this book. I'm going to put it in some book someday. But just thinking about the ways that you would spend your time if you only had time to spend, and you, there was no work beyond the work of surviving. There were definitely no forms of entertainment beyond what you could kind of create. In my book, Cal and Frida, they have an activity called thinking with a capital T, where they lie down and they give each other, it's like what you do when you're stoned, and you give each other a word and you just kind of ponder that word. I think I would do a lot of that. But I mean, I also have my characters, like Cal is wishing for, I think he says like a sports radio jackass that he could just listen to. And she's always craving lattes. I mean, it's a close enough to our world that those things existed for them at one point, and so they can still long for them. And my hope is that that reminds the reader that you might have something now that you maybe will not have in the future, like lattes.
You did a really, I would say, masterful job of making me feel that longing. You know, when Frida's reminiscing about those small joys of life, what they add to a life, you know, things like a holiday or baking something or a kitchen gadget, you know, just tiny things that bring pleasure. You know, they are to be savored, you know.
Yeah. And the other thing, I mean, they're to be savored now that we have them. But one of the reasons why they're sort of in this mess, and this is coming from somebody who has a lot of gadgets and things, I'm not, are sort of present day need for things. Mm-hmm. Like at one point, there's, I think it's the very beginning, Frida thinks about the plastic doodads that, like, on tags on shirts that are probably one of the reasons why the world is going down into flames, of just sort of our material need for more and more and more things is sort of one of the reasons why they're in this mess in the first place. And yet, that's not to say that some of those things are deeply valuable and meaningful to us. And that's why Frida is sort of brought to her knees when she sees a new Band-Aid, because she remembers the pull of those objects and how they can fulfill you in certain ways.
Yeah. Again, it raises just these great questions about, you know, building, what kind of life is meaningful and brings us joy without the excess.
Yeah.
And the
waste.
Can
we have it?
Yeah. Is that possible? Again, we're speaking with Eden Lepucky, author of California, her debut novel that is It debuted at number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list. I haven't checked it this week.
I think right now it's at number, it was number, not that I remember these things. Oh, it was number 3 and then it was promptly off the list for 1 week. And then it came back at number 16.
Hey, hey.
And then it came back at 22. So I don't know how much longer I can hang on there. I'm like hanging on my hands. Nails are going down the wall, the cliff's edge. But I mean, even to be on it at 22 is kind of a miracle to me.
Yay. Congratulations.
Thanks.
That's awesome. One of the most exciting things about this book is that it really has brought authors and, you know, the readers into a kind of a movement to help. People have gotten involved in this dispute between mm-hmm. Amazon and Hachette. And I didn't realize until Sherman Alexie appeared on The Colbert Show to plug your book that he found incredible. I think that was his word. I could have died right then.
Oh, I did die. I'm speaking to you from the afterlife.
You know, I became aware of the plight of mm-hmm. the writer, especially the first-time writer, that I didn't realize that pre-ordering of a book can make or break it, and that it's all about the pre-publicity and pre-ordering. What an impact did that Colbert bump have on this book?
Well, I will say first that I wasn't quite aware either that pre-sales were that important. And I think my publisher purposely wasn't really talking to me about it because we were in a really precarious, anxiety-producing situation. And I'll say that it's still a situation for all Hachette writers right now. Mm-hmm. And even books that are out have like 3 to 4 week wait periods on Amazon. And they're still the ones that are suffering during this corporate dispute. And I was very happy that Colbert wanted to bring this issue to the general public because it was an issue that was a big deal for me and among all writers and people in the book industry and publishing industry, but not really for general readers. I had friends who were asking me like, how come I can't get your book from Amazon? And they had like no idea this was happening. So it really widened the conversation. And I'm grateful for that because it seems like an issue that it is an issue that people should be discussing and figuring out what they feel about it. But the mm-hmm. fact that they didn't even know it was happening was worrisome to me. I had the pleasure of meeting Sherman Alexie actually last night in Seattle, and I mean, I just said to him, "You changed my life." I never expected this book to be as big as it has gotten, and I know it's as big as it has gotten because he did that.
I heard about it before that. I'll just say that.
I mean, it's not to say that it was going to be. I mean, it was with a major publisher, and they were working very hard on its behalf, and it was on summer reading lists, and it was getting reviews. But I'm not naive to think that I could have done this all on my own. And it's just that there are so many good books that are published by major publishing houses that have paid good money for them, and they have a lot of people working for them. But they still, there are just so many books out there. Mm-hmm. So to have found these readers because of Sherman Alexie and Stephen Colbert, I just can't stop being so grateful and sort of like flummoxed that all this has happened to me. And because I admire Sherman Alexie so much, mm-hmm. that also it's just an added bonus. And, you know, I had read so much of his work in college and graduate school, but it had been a few years since I'd read him, and I picked up Blasphemy, which is his collected stories, and I read them kind of in preparation for meeting him and doing this event with him. And I was just struck again by how powerful his work is and how funny, and it's so funny and moving, and it's like Raymond Carver but much more irreverent and sort of more glowing or transcendent in some way. So I just felt like a newly wow that he had chosen my book because I think he's such a great writer. And I was just like, wow. Yesterday I was on the airplane just thinking, I can't believe this writer of this talent liked my book. Even if he hadn't been on the show and he just told me like in an email, that would have been enough, you know?
Yeah, I do. Eden Lopatky, thank you so much for being our guest and for gracing our town on your book tour.
Of course. Thank you for having me. This was fun.
How can folks get in touch with you and learn more about you?
I'm at edenlopucki.com. That's EDANLEPUCKI. I'm on Twitter at EdenL. And I'm on Tumblr at italicsmine.
Thank you again, Eden Lopucki, for being our guest. And thank you, Amelia Pazanza and Carrie Neal at Little Brown & Company, for your help with coordination. I'm Leanne Kranz. Thank you for listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor La Peña Flamenca de Portland on Friday, August 22nd. This month, co-sponsor La Peña Flamenca de Portland presents El Cuadro Gallo. Featuring Christina Lawrence, accompanied by Jeffrey Trapp on guitar, Paul Brady on cante, Nick Hutch on cajon, and Brenna McDonald on palmas. Again, that's La Peña Flamenca de Portland and El Cuadro Gallo on Friday, August 22nd at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Portland Hawthorne Hostel's 11th annual Bike In Movie on Saturday, August 23rd from 6 to 10 p.m. The film will be True Fans, an award-winning documentary about an epic cross-country bicycle journey of three men traveling to the Basketball Hall of Fame and discovering the real America along the way. Musical entertainment will be provided by Train River, an eclectic collection of bluegrass and string band musicians. Again, that's the 11th annual Bike In Movie showing of True Fans on Saturday, August 23rd from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Portland Hawthorne Hostel, 3031 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. This is Kathleen Stevenson for the Radio Zine on KBOO Portland. My guest is Drew Cameron, who is co-founder of Combat Paper, a national program that works directly with communities affected by combat to transform military uniforms into sheets of handmade paper, which become works of art. For a couple more days, he is artist in residence at the Museum of Contemporary Craft in Portland. He is a hand papermaker, printer, and book artist based in San Francisco. He has a degree in forestry from the University of Vermont and served in the U.S. Army from 2000 to 2006. Drew, thanks for coming into KBOO.
My pleasure. I'm super, super happy to be here.
Explain a little bit more for our listeners about what combat paper is.
Yeah, in its simplest form, combat paper uses the traditional technique of hand